Hello and welcome to Dealcast, the voice of Merger Market, the world's leading publication about mergers and acquisitions. I'm Juliana Needham, and as a journalist covering the space for more than a decade, I can safely say very little has provided quite such a rollercoaster ride of rumour, briefing and lobbying that we've seen ahead of the UK Chancellor of the Exchequer, Rachel Reeves, delivering her second budget. With £26 billion in tax rises, it's certainly proved as significant as billed. So in this episode, we're focusing on what the budget means for British private equity. With Reeves' words still ringing in their ears, Merger Market's global commentary editor John West is joined by Perry Yam, who's a partner at BCLP and one of the UK's most experienced private equity lawyers. Perry's advised sponsors and management teams on complex buyouts, carve-outs and IPO exits for more than three decades, and his insight into mid-market deal dynamics is second to none. John and Perry tackle how this budget, designed to restore fiscal headroom and provide space for rate cuts, affects sponsor sentiment, portfolio strategies and exit planning. Plus, we'll look at corporate sector-specific impacts and whether measures like the share stamp duty holiday could tilt more IPOs towards the London Stock Exchange.
Perry, it's a pleasure to welcome you to Dealcast. Let's kick straight on. This budget from Rachel Reeves felt consequential, but risk-averse, tactical, not strategic. Before we get into the specifics, how would you say in the private equity community in the UK, 24 hours later, this budget has been received?
Well, good to meet you, John, and thanks for the opportunity to talk with you. I think the budget was disappointing for most people, if not everyone. I don't think there were many winners, apart from those who perhaps use rail links and who've got their rail fares frozen. I suspect that the Parliamentary Labour Party quite enjoyed it, given the fiscal management, and in particular with the scrapping of the second child cap. But aside from that, I think business probably won't welcome it. I don't think the markets so far have particularly warmed to it. And I suspect that the voters, entrepreneurs, managers, and corporates won't enjoy the outcome of it either. My take on it is that it was very much a political budget. It was to, I suspect, safeguard her job and that of the Prime Minister for the immediate foreseeable future, as opposed to really addressing what the country needs, which is surprising given that it was bannered at least as being a budget for growth. And yet when you look at the policies, there wasn't really much to support the growth dynamic or the growth mechanics that perhaps the country has been.
Well, if we could just drill into that ever so slightly, Perry, because I think, you know, there were some raised eyebrows about the lack of productivity or innovation measures in there. There were a couple of bits and pieces. I mean, there were increases in the allowance and investment limit for the venture capital trusts and enterprise investment scheme initiatives. And those potentially could help to scale up certain companies that could become primary buyout candidates for the sponsor universe. Are there a few nuggets of things that could be of interest there?
I hear what you say about the VCTs, but of course it was counterbalanced by the reduction in the tax benefit to half at 20%. And so query whether that's going to be a sufficient incentive for people to invest in structures which...
So they've increased the allowances, but taken away some of the tax advantage of those allowances.
Absolutely. And when you look at the overall performance and returns of the VCTs, it's questionable whether or not without the kicker of the tax benefit, it's sufficiently attractive. So I'm a bit wary of that. You might argue, I'm just preempting what you might say next, about the three-year holiday for the stamp duty and a location of choice for UK listed companies. I think that's possibly attractive, but I think you need to consider the overall environment and the attractiveness of an IPO, generally speaking. If we look at AIM, for example, which was created in 1995, it hasn't really been a success in terms of technology forum for companies coming to raise capital. It's considered to be quite an illiquid market.
And David Cameron's high growth segment in the 2010s also died a death in a similar vein.
Exactly. And so query whether the public markets, in particular to address your original question, for exits for private equity is sufficiently attractive. I remain to be convinced over the 30 odd years of practice. I haven't seen on a comparative basis a significant number of IPOs compared to secondary transactions and one private equity firm buying, you know, a smaller asset from the other and just selling to strategics in the current marketplace. So I remain pretty uninspired, if you like, by the measures that you have alluded to and that I've just talked about in terms of the capital markets.
I'll just step in there because, as you know, if you speak to any equity capital markets banker or capital markets lawyer, they'll tell you the pipeline is strong and it's perennially strong. But in all seriousness, 2026, there's quite a few big IPOs coming down the pipe, obviously Evidencia being one. We just had BC Partners and Pollen Street bring Shawbrook to market, a modest pop around 5%, but, you know, a challenger bank, quite an interesting name. Things aren't as bad as all that, are they? There's a route to market.
Look, there is always going to be companies listed on the London Stock Exchange. I'm looking at it as a numbers game. And if you think about the number of investments that the 200 or so leading PE firms based in the UK associated with the BVCA, you look at the number of transactions they do on a given in a given year and look at the percentage that are brought to the capital markets. Well, I don't know the statistic. Perhaps you could check it, but I'd imagine it's less than 5%.
Let's look at some statistics because the equity capital markets transactions are certainly muted by comparison to certainly the exits that have taken place via M&A this year. But M&A progress on the exit side for sponsors has been relatively modest, and there are good reasons for that. I mean, if you look at autumn 24, there was a budget. Then in 25, you go to the spring statement. You slam straight into Liberation Day, and then you come back from your summer holiday and you're preparing for a budget, and that's felt interminable. So there's been lots of on-diary action that has really thrown the deal-making process. And sponsor exits in the UK year-to-date, only up 5%, £24 billion, but up more than 70% in the fourth quarter so far. So it's accelerated, certainly, and even as we came towards the budget. So is the exit environment, I don't want to say it's going to be a help that there's a slew of extra taxes in the UK economy, but at least Rachel Reeves has put the fiscal policy to bed for a year, right? We're going to get some rate cuts. Things look okay for 26, don't they?
Yeah, I suspect for private equity institutions, they will look at fiscal policy, what's been implemented. They will look at the taxes that are being imposed, and they will look at the restraints on and cutback in government spending. And as you have suggested, that will hopefully allow the governor of the Bank of England to affect monetary policy with a further reduction in interest rates, and therefore borrowing costs will be reduced, allowing two things in particular. The first is the PE shops being able to leverage their equity at a far more sensible pricing level, but also for the consumers. Assuming, and this is a big assumption, something we should perhaps talk about later, John, but assuming that consumers can gain some degree of confidence and use whatever disposable income they have to spend on, you know, products, assets, services to generate improved performance from the corporates, which will then attract better valuations. That will hopefully be the trigger for private equity firms who have until now, I hate this phrase, but you'll know what I mean immediately, dry powder, be able to then borrow money at cheaper rates for companies that are better performing and, you know, trigger and kickstart the transaction cycle in 2026, given that they haven't done as much as perhaps they would have liked in the first three quarters of 25, for reasons which you and I are, you know, very familiar, whether it's supply chain interruption, Middle East wars, Russia, Ukraine, and indeed the last 6 weeks or so, all the uncertainty around the budget generally, and of course the OBR criticizing, or not necessarily, but giving a very downgraded opinion and view on the UK's growth forecasts. I think it's 0.3%, which is not particularly encouraging, and then all of that has stymied activity levels. But as you say, the fiscal policy might allow monetary policy to facilitate greater transaction activity.
Well, let's look at a few sectors that have been impacted by the budget changes. Retail seems to me to be a significant one, and there are two sides to the coin. On the one side, you've got quite a substantial rate increase for businesses that have rateable properties of more than £500,000. So that's going to kick in for supermarkets and larger retailers, and certainly the profile of retailers that many sponsors will be looking out or holding or considering within their portfolios if they exist already. But also, obviously, the minimum wage has increased, what, more than 4%. There are two sides to that as well, because obviously it puts a bit more money in the pockets of some consumers, but equally, you have to fund those wages. What does this mean? What does this mix of policy, which sort of is a bit Janus-faced, it gives with one hand and takes with another, what does that mean across consumer-facing businesses, retail, real estate?
Yeah, I don't think it, from my perspective, I don't think it has any material impact one way or the other. I think far more concerning was the increase in the requirement for national insurance contributions, which were brought in previously by the Chancellor. And
this was in the autumn 24 budget.
Correct. And for the large entities, retail or otherwise, with large workforces, all I've heard from private equity sponsors who have backed businesses which have a large workforce is the huge impact on the fixed cost. I suspect that this minimum wage and retail rates and so on pales into insignificance when you think about a company which has got 200 plus employees with the national insurance hit that's had to take on and in affecting its fixed costs. So I'm pretty wary on the minimum wage stuff. I think it's more noise than going to have a material impact on the companies and the portfolio's performance.
Well, we've seen a lot of sponsor wariness about retail and indeed the care sector, which also is very exposed to those on lower wages. Let's move to a slightly sexier space, tech. We are in a tech revolution. We can't move for discussion about the magnitude of the way that AI is going to change all our lives. Surprisingly little in this budget on AI and innovation. And from the sponsor perspective, quite a lot of software as a service or SaaS companies in the portfolio, many of them concerned about the disruption from AI to their entire business models. Was there anything that you saw in the budget that could move the dial at all on tech? And which segments are, you know, is there a degree of wanting to sit on the sidelines and see how AI plays out before making further SaaS plays?
So I think there are two points there. The first is AI, and the other is software as a service. Obviously, software as a service is more established. It's been around for 5-10 years now. PE have backed it significantly over that period. It has a key role to play. And for businesses which are, to use their phrase, disruptors in the various sectors, SaaS, was and remains to a large extent quite revolutionary. It drives efficiency, it brings down costs for the customers, and has been hugely attractive. I think it's very early stage for AI, and I'm not sure that people are going to dive in necessarily until they've got a proven case. No one wants to be the first and to fall on their face. I think they want to see some proven business models, some proven AI businesses. And for example, in the legal profession, we're seeing a lot of it, driving efficiency, reducing man hour, getting results for transactional activity delivered far quicker, and therefore reducing the cost that you have to pass on to clients. So it's been exciting. It's a challenge. It's embryonic. It's nascent in its evolution. But I think that AI will be, as everyone's spoken about, will be hugely impactful for private equity as an asset class. But it's perhaps too early. In fact, some of the AI companies that service the legal world have been serviced with venture or seed capital in a Series A, Series B, as opposed to private equity leverage finance. They're at that early stage. So maybe come back to me in 18 months, 2 years, and let's see the first couple of big companies which have been acquired or invested in by private equity as opposed to venture capital.
But do you think there's possibility for, I mean, you mentioned how transformative it can be, and you've seen the results of it in legal practice. Whoever wins among the in the shootout amongst the Magnificent Seven, whoever wins that Uber battle at the hyperscaler stage, the technology is here to stay, and the compute power is clearly required. Is there a private equity play, perhaps co-investing with infrastructure players on the data centers? Because whoever wins that tussle, the compute power is required, surely.
Well, data centers are a challenge in themselves. As you'll be aware, the challenge with data centers is being able to link the power supply to the real estate asset. And that has been the hurdle. And that has been what has prevented the growth and the progress, and arguably the lack of extensive investment by private equity. The sites exist, the technology exists. Linking the power to the site with the technology remains the issue, and the cost associated in bringing the two together, as I understand it, speaking to my real estate colleagues who do a lot of this, I think, as you may know, the firm is ranked very highly for real estate work. That's the challenge. So it's a very different issue, I think, from that. No one would argue against the requirement to improve efficiency through technology. And no one would perhaps argue that having data centers providing the backup resources and the technology hub for that is anything but sensible. But from a financial perspective, making them efficient, I think, remains a challenge.
Mentioned energy there, which brings us very neatly back to the budget, because obviously in Ed Miliband, we have an energy secretary who is rather celebrated in green circles and rather loathed by North Sea exploration and production executives. Again, we had no cut in the windfall tax that applies to North Sea production, some limited extension to North Sea licenses, but overall, not too much to support businesses in terms of improving energy prices, which is, you will know, particularly high in the UK versus even the rest of Europe. Is energy not just a pinch point for data centers, but for many other sectors that sponsors are involved in?
I think it is. I just question whether she had the resources, the wherewithal within the constraints that were imposed upon her, arguably through this black hole. As it was, and we've heard this phrase, smorgasbord, and there were so many different pockets that she could attack. I just query whether she had the wherewithal to go after anything that would relate to energy. We've got the green levy was reduced as £150 for households on an annual basis. She probably felt restricted and couldn't do very much more. And perhaps maybe she's keeping that, for the next run around, because having attacked fiscal policy and made sure she's got sufficient headroom, I assume she's not going to come back to taxes again, to your earlier point, next year, assuming she's still in the seat, and maybe she'll look at other avenues, and obviously energy transition, fossil fuels will be an avenue open to her. Of course, electric cars charging on a mileage basis is a further imposition, is not helpful. It's in fact quite the opposite. So maybe she's leaving energy for a rainy day.
Now, you mentioned earlier about the increase in national insurance that took place in 2024 in that budget. Obviously, there is an increase in both in national insurance and income tax with the with the fiscal drag that is going to bring in some £60 billion in tax over the next 4 to 5 years. Quite a significant tax increase, and it moves the UK up to a tax take of roughly 38% of GDP, much closer to Germany and much further away from, say, the US and Canada. Now, you've got that higher tax environment, plus you've got a lot of sponsors who are sat on 2020, 2020, 2021 investments. They, 2026 is really execution year. They have to deliver that DPI if they want to go back out and fundraise. But there's this higher tax environment, and there is a bit of a valuation lag versus, for example, the United States. Does a higher tax burden, in your view, potentially make that valuation gap with the US even bigger?
So it's really interesting, John, because I'm misreading the situation, and I'm looking to the city and to the markets to see how they're going to respond to this budget. It's too soon, clearly, but in the next 7 to 10 days, we're going to get a view. I think equity markets didn't really respond at all yesterday. Debt markets were slightly encouraged. I looked at that quite closely. So the next 10 days are going to be very pertinent. But I'd say this to you. The freezing of the levels for tax without raising the rates, I think will bring, I heard one estimate, 1 million people within, you know, a higher band. But of course, she's extending those for 3 years from the current day of 28. We've got the last possible date for the election will be the 2029 calendar year. Call me a skeptic, but I wonder whether they'll even have any influence at all, which is why I go back to where I started. And how does the city and the markets view these things? A lot of your mansion tax is only going to raise 400 million. It doesn't come in till 28. Okay, we've got the pensions impact next year, 26, but it's not immediate. These freezing the entry levels for the various tax hurdles, 28. It's on the never. It's in the future. There's nothing happening meaningfully for another 2 years. So
a lot of the spending commitments are front loaded, and a lot of the fiscal tightening, the tax increases, come in later on.
And as one commentator on TV last night said, raising taxes to fund welfare is no way in which to grow an economy. And that's my personal view. I mean, I did economics at university a long time ago. I remember studying Keynes, and it's not too dissimilar. But to me, it doesn't stack up. So I'd be interested to see how the markets respond. In terms of the valuation gap that you talk about, the challenge there, and I made this point earlier, I said I'd come back to it, is my view on the success or otherwise of private equity investment is very, very basic. And it comes down to the man in the street or woman in the street. Do they have confidence? Do they have disposable income? And are they spending money? Because if they are, as I said earlier, the companies are benefiting, and they are they're meeting their targets, and they're achieving their revenue targets and so on. And that means that those assets become attractive, whether it's in retail, the restaurant chains, whether it's in high-end leisure, Louis Vuitton, LMVH, or whether it's in just software as a service, as we talked about, and corporates taking the plunge and investing in their infrastructure. If we have that degree of confidence, if those businesses are performing, private equity will be, that'll be the trigger, and they'll be investing and buying businesses. The trouble today, through 25 to date, and I'm hoping will not be the case through 26, is that because those businesses are behind budget, who haven't met their targets, they're coming to PE saying, well, on our look forward EBITDA run rate, et cetera, we're applying a multiple, say, of 10. And when we valued our business last year on a turnover of, say, 20 million, 10 times 20 was 200. Well, now our turnover is 16. 10 times 16 is 160. We're not suffering a 40 million deficit. There's your valuation gap. So what I'm saying to you is that I'm hoping the markets will be supportive of the budget, will recognize that, it's not too impactful in the immediate term. The consumer confidence post-Christmas will return, the businesses will perform, and that as I said earlier, dry powder will be invested on the back of monetary policy, and interest rates coming down to fuel and sustain increased activity levels.
And notwithstanding some of the points that you've made about tax increases, at the very least, she has, at least theoretically, at least on paper, although it's backloaded, increased her fiscal headroom, more than doubled it to 21.7 billion, which hopefully will provide a degree of comfort to the market. Speaking of comfort, I suspect that the private equity industry itself will have taken some comfort from the fact that Rachel Reeves did not come back for another bite at carried interest. The British Private Equity and Venture Capital Association, BVCA, did a pretty good job last year of anticipating that there would be a rise rather than trying to stop it entirely, and therefore getting in the room to have that conversation. Those conversations have continued. Rachel Reeves spoke to the BVCA recently. There was no further attack. Do you think the industry is kind of relieved? Is there a sense that there won't be another attack on the industry for the rest of this parliament? Or is the higher tax environment, we saw James Brocklebank from Advent, of course, up sticks from the UK to Luxembourg. Is there a talent retention issue because it's becoming a higher in tax environment? What is the mood music within the industry?
So I'd make two comments, John. First is, I don't think anyone was expecting carried interest to be attacked. I mean, that was, you know, of a prior year. It was a one and done. And of course, you mustn't lose sight of the fact that although the interest rate has increased, of course, it is going to next year fall into the income tax regime as opposed to capital regime. And so the double whammy was imposed last year rather than this. And I don't think there was any challenge to that. So you say relief. Yes, maybe, but I don't think there's any concern that it was going to be challenged again. The second comment I'd make is what I have noticed, which is very disturbing, and maybe you have in your inquiries and your research, I've noticed that some of the successful private equity GPs are relocating. I could quote three or four different locations. I'm sure you've come across them that are very attractive for these people who no longer see the UK environment as tax efficient for their gains and their income. Milan in Italy is one. Dubai is another. Israel is a third. And you've of course always had and still have, you know, Monaco in France, Principality. So it's quite worrying for me to see heads of various European PE firms, but with London presence, having the founders of those firms or lead people going offshore, Jersey, Guernsey, of course, as well, going offshore and working, you know, from abroad. I mean, they're still, you know, UK headquartered PE GPs, but they have key leaders no longer in the UK paying tax. And that, I think, is a disturbing feature. And what that reflects, as I said before, is that they no longer see the UK as an environment where they have to be located to work. Of course, COVID changed all of that. Remote working is accepted now. But as an environment that they want to be paying such large swathes of tax. I mean, only yesterday, Mittal, of course, announced on the news that he was relocating. I forget, you'll remind me of the jurisdiction he's moving, country he's moving to. But that won't be the last, I'm sure. And that's a disturbing trend.
The final question I was going to ask you, actually, was, it's very easy to say, well, we need to adopt Luxembourg's tax regime to get more funds registered here, to have that leadership not leave these shores. But within the art of what is politically possible, we put you in number 11, Perry. What would be, within the art of the politically possible, something that a chancellor could do that would make a difference to sentiment within the industry vis-a-vis London?
It's very difficult because what is politically acceptable is very different to what would perhaps retain the trust and confidence of the leaders of the PE community. You have to understand, you do understand, that they are such a small percentage. You know, you've got 1% of the population paying higher rate tax, and you've got, of that 1%, what fraction of it are millionaires and billionaires, and these are very successful private equity founders. And so what's politically acceptable is very challenging. I think perhaps a better question might be, what are the changes that the government might consider on the back of representations from the BVCA to make private equity a sustainable business and to make it more attractive for LPs to invest in, you know, UK-based GPs. And in answer to that, I would say three or four things. I would say your regulatory approvals need to be expedited, made simpler, faster. A recent phenomenon.
And the CMA, to be fair, has made some moves there, right?
They have, and they're moving in the right direction. But I think there's more that could be done. We've recognised more recently, for example, the imposition of the requirement under the NSIA for anything that touches
the National Security and Investments Act.
That's right. And, you know, there's an increasingly wide net placed over the stuff that has, you talked before about defence and government contracts, that, you know, if we can simplify that process, if we can have certainty around the economy, that will hopefully make, as we've discussed already, the investment horizon quicker and more accessible. I think access to capital, she's made a start with that, with the stock exchange that we've talked about. and VCTs. And finally, I would say management incentives, share option schemes, anything that would give a greater and fairer degree of tax treatment for founders, managers, the people that private equity institutions back and support. If we can find, or if the government, together with the BBCA and the Manchester Treasury, can come up with ways that make it even more attractive, given that we've got hikes coming in income tax, to try and get as much benefit from capital treatment under these schemes, then...
And the Chancellor did announce yesterday a consultation for entrepreneurs ending on the 28th of February to make proposals precisely along those lines, I believe.
Correct. And in a similar vein, of course, we've got all of the discussions previously and indeed continuing about pension schemes being able to invest in used private capital to enhance investment in private businesses that way. So depending on how that works out, that will also have, I hope, a meaningful impact on the attractiveness of the UK as an environment for private equity alongside everything else that we've talked about. One of the final thing I would say on this, and is a theme we haven't touched upon, but is a tool which has been utilized by private equity, is the continuation vehicles. Because as you'll know, private equity are effectively 10-year closed-end funds. They typically invest the money, capital commitments within the first 5 years and spend from years 3 to 10 to the next 7 trying to improve those businesses and divest themselves. And after about year 5 or 6, they go out and try and raise another fund. This new phenomenon of continuation vehicle, which is rather ingenious, I think, provided you can navigate the potential conflict issues. And these are GP-led secondaries, so the general partner will go out and take the last remaining residual assets or asset in a fund, which has run out of cash, and put it into a new vehicle, attracting new limited partners and or having the existing limited partners roll over into this new vehicle as a method of two or three things. It prevents the sale of the asset at an undervalue. It allows greater revenue to be generated from the new vehicle to sustain further growth of the business in question, maximizing the potential value. And what it does is also is allows the GP to effectively close out the old fund and raise a new fund. And so I think that's another way in which, in answer to your question, if we can facilitate and or continue to facilitate and encourage and create an environment in which continuation vehicles can flourish, then I think that will enhance the landscape for concerns over, you know, orphaned assets within funds. For example, the fund might not have enough money to give further capital to the business to allow it to achieve its potential. So that's a very useful, I think, tool in which you can help to allow the assets within the private equity funds to achieve their full potential.
Just one final follow-up on that. If you take an asset like Froneri, which PAI Partners obviously has very successfully run, which is throwing off cash, massive in ice creams, it's very, you can see why the continuation vehicle CV2, CV squared approach works. But aren't LPs in general going to be a bit tired of this merry-go-round if some of the same tired assets are repackaged and gussied up and put into a continuation vehicle?
I don't actually think so, John, for a couple of reasons. I wouldn't characterize it as a merry-go-round. I would characterize it as a, as I said earlier, as a method to maximize potential and to maximize the value in something which is not yet fully baked. And of course, the existing LPs have the opportunity to roll over into the new vehicle. But at the same time, which I think is hugely important.
And often at a co-investment level, right?
Correct. But at the same time, it gives them a liquidity event should they want it. So they get the best of both worlds. They're not obliged to follow. They can take their money and exit if they want to. And so I think it's a very neat and ingenious, I'm not sure who thought of it, but it's an ingenious way of, you know, getting money back to LPs, preserving the value, maximizing future value, giving them a second bite at the cherry if they want to, closing the pre-existing fund, raising a new fund without the limitations of the old one still being there. So I would say that I don't agree with you on that, and I actually think that it's a very clever tool to continue and facilitate the evergreen, if you like, way of generating value for limited partners.
Perry Yam, thank you very much for joining us.
Many thanks to John West and to Perry Yam for that analysis of a long-awaited budget. And just to point out, we are recording this on the 27th of November. If you'd like to hear more from John, Continental Drift is his column on macroeconomic and geopolitical risks and opportunities impacting the M&A pipeline on both sides of the pond, and that runs weekly on Merger Market. And thanks for listening to this week's episode of Dealcast from Merger Market. I'm Juliana Needham. If you've enjoyed today's episode, please subscribe, and if you're on an app that supports it, do give us a rating and review. To find out more about this episode and Merger Market, have a look at our show notes. See you next time.